and Simulink technical computing software on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young. Coming up, Yasser Arafat asks militant groups to reinstate the truce. Will anyone listen? We'll have a report from Jerusalem.
In Alabama, a 5,000-pound replica of the Ten Commandments is moved.
A student sues Arizona over a tuition hike at his state school.
And 200 private schools band together in a new prepaid college tuition plan.
Also, shopping for tomorrow's Major League Baseball stars on Cape Cod.
My name is Stan Meek, and I'm the scouting director of the Florida Marlins, and here really to look for guys that we think are prospects that we can look for the draft in the years to come.
These stories and reconsidering Julius Caesar coming up here and now.
News is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stachow. A controversial Ten Commandments monument is no longer in public view at the Alabama Supreme Court. NPR's Debbie Elliott reports.
Workers rolled the 2.5-ton granite stone from the rotunda of the Alabama Judicial Building this morning, moving the display to a more private location in the courthouse. About 100 protesters who had been camped outside vowing to protect the monument shouted and prayed as the object of their crusade was wheeled away. The director of Americans United for Separation of Church and State, the Reverend Barry Lynn, called it a tremendous victory for the rule of law and respect for religious diversity. A federal judge last year ruled the Ten Commandments monument violates the constitutional ban on government promotion of religion, but Alabama Chief Justice Roy Moore refused to comply with a federal court order to remove the display, so his associate justices ordered it out. Moore has been suspended from office, facing ethics charges. Debbie Elliott, NPR News.
Oklahoma's Attorney General today filed the first criminal charges against Bernard Ebbers, the former head of WorldCom Incorporated. The action's part of a wider complaint that also named the telecommunications company now known as MCI and other former top executives. The complaint accuses Ebbers, the executives, and the company of violating state securities laws by giving false information to investors. MCI filed the nation's largest bankruptcy more than a year ago in an $11 billion accounting scandal. The U.S. military says two more American soldiers have been killed in attacks in Iraq. The BBC's Susanna Price reports from Baghdad.
In the first attack during the morning, a soldier was killed and three others wounded by an explosive device. The incident took place in Fallujah, west of Baghdad, where many Saddam Hussein loyalists are believed to be based. Just half an hour later, a military convoy was targeted in Baghdad and another soldier killed. Such attacks are taking place on an almost daily basis. On Tuesday, it was announced that more Americans have been killed since combat operations were declared over than during the war itself. However, the American administrator in Iraq, Paul Bremer, said the attacks were almost entirely confined to the area between Baghdad and Tikrit to the north and didn't pose any strategic threat to the United States or coalition forces.
BBC's Susanna Price in Baghdad. Palestinian President Yasser Arafat today asked militant groups to honor a truce they formally abandoned after Israel killed a senior Hamas leader. The Hamas official was killed in retaliation for a deadly bus bombing. This marks Arafat's first public effort to restore calm since last week's violence. A number of people may have been killed in a shooting today at a Chicago warehouse. Chicago police say six men, one man believed to be a former employee, shot five people at an industrial building before being arrested by police. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 18 points. The Nasdaq is up 3. You're listening to NPR News. In NPR's business update, the president of Mazda Motor Corporation has resigned his post. He'll be taking over Ford's operations in Europe. From member station WDET in Detroit, Celeste Headley reports.
Lewis Booth's announcement that he'll leave Mazda came as a surprise. He took the helm of Japan's fifth-largest automaker in June of 2002 and was expected to stay for at least 2 years. Booth led Ford's African and Asia-Pacific divisions before going to Mazda. He's facing significant challenges with his new job. Ford's European arm posted a pre-tax loss of more than $500 million in the 3 months ending in June. That announcement was followed closely by the resignation of Ford Europe's president, Martin Leach. Analysts say Ford's market share in Europe has fallen steadily since the late 1990s, while Mazda has enjoyed great success there. Mazda's overall revenue grew 10% in the 3 months through June. Ford owns one-third of the Mazda Motor Corporation. For NPR News, I'm Celeste Headlee in Detroit.
The corporation that owns the Philip Morris Tobacco Companies will offer a higher-than-expected dividend to investors. The Altria Group Board of Directors today approved a 6.3% dividend hike. Altria, which owns Philip Morris and most of Kraft Foods, said its quarterly dividend will now be 68 cents a share. Yesterday, Kraft raised its quarterly dividend by 20%. Finland's Nokia took steps to bolster its position as the world's leading mobile phone maker today. The firm presented two cheap models aimed at developing handset markets such as India and Russia. Analysts say the move shows the increased importance of developing countries to telecommunications companies. On Wall Street, the Dow is off 18, the Nasdaq is up 3. I'm Frank Stachow, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Amundsen Foundation for support of the NPR Endowment, helping to ensure NPR's financial future.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Locked in a power struggle with his prime minister, PLO chairman Yasser Arafat today called on militant Palestinian groups to reinstate the ceasefire they broke off last week. And Arafat also called on Washington to stop Israel from carrying out missile attacks targeting the militants. We'll have a report from Jerusalem in a moment, but first. Americans are reacting to the breakdown of the Mideast peace process. This past weekend, I happened to be one of dozens of hikers in Bryce Canyon, Utah, forced back into the lodge by a ferocious thunderstorm. Even though on vacation, everyone had a thought about the breakdown of the Mideast peace process.
Oh, I think it's unfortunate, but I guess I always found it hard to believe that it would last at all. I just kind of had a feeling that it was a matter of time before all hell broke loose again.
Because?
The hatred is just so ingrained in the Israelis and the Palestinians that I think it's not something where you can just sign a letter and say, okay, we all love each other now and we're going to make peace.
Do you think that the Bush administration could have gotten more involved in the roadmap, or do you think it was destined to fail?
Absolutely not. You cannot keep two dogs from fighting. No matter what you do, if the two dogs want to fight, they're going to fight. And that's what you have over there.
Where are you from?
South Bend, Indiana.
You've heard the Middle East peace is pretty much collapsed.
I think the Arabs have to be more considerate of our value for human life.
Hamas supports the suicide bombings. That disturbs you?
It disturbs me because they just don't have the same value for human life that we have. I mean, it's hard for me to step on a bug and kill it.
This is, and now my husband and my two sons are hiking.
They're out in this?
Yes.
All right, so you have a lot on your mind, but I was just wondering if you've been paying attention to some of the international news, the end of the ceasefire in the Middle East, for instance.
It's disturbing. It's all disturbing. But I'm on vacation, so I'm trying not to think about it.
Voices from Bryce Canyon in Utah. Well, we turn now to Charles Radin. He covers the Middle East for the Boston Globe and joins us from Jerusalem. And Charles, you write this morning that in addition to the possible end of the roadmap, some see the end of the road for Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas, a moderate Palestinian believed to be a supporter of the peace plan. So tell us about that.
Well, some see the end of him because the peace plan is not moving. Others, among his supporters, are saying he ought to try to resign, because that would make the Israelis and the militant groups and the terror groups and the Americans all sit up and take notice, because he fills a fairly special niche. There's not a long list of people who could take his place.
Do you think there is any chance he will resign?
I do. I think there's an even better chance if he tries. I'd give you higher odds that they get him to stay and that it works, that it would be a maneuver and that it could work.
Well, many, including the White House, feel that Yasser Arafat has been undermining Mahmoud Abbas. Meanwhile, today, Arafat has called for a ceasefire from militant groups Hamas and Islamic Jihad. He's asking them to go back to the truce. Do you think that those groups will listen to that call?
They may, because the Israelis have got them sweating. And there are people who have previously spoken freely and publicly in favor of these groups and in favor of the suicide attacks who have been forced to go underground and are in hiding and nowhere to be seen because of these strikes of recent weeks.
Mm. Let's talk a little more about that. Yesterday, an Israeli strike with an intended Hamas target missed its target and killed an innocent bystander. How effective, other than that, obviously, are the strikes?
Well, the people who they haven't missed have been important people, and they've hit enough of them that I spoke to someone, a fairly high official in the Israeli Foreign Ministry yesterday, who said they were very pleased with the result, even if they miss one once in a while, because, to use his words, these guys now feel like we're feeling. They're afraid to go out on the streets. They know we're going to shoot them if we see them. They don't use their cell phones. They can't live in their houses. So this is viewed by the Israelis as being an effective play against them.
Charlie, could you paint a little more of that picture? Because we are reading stories about Palestinian militants shaving their beards, wearing women's clothing, jumping from rooftop to avoid the Israelis.
Oh, it's absolutely true. Though I haven't seen anyone in women's clothing who I know to be a Hamas member. I was in Jenin in the refugee camp there not very long ago and spoke with the head of the Al-Aqsa Brigades in that camp. And he was extremely skittish. He moved from house to house rapidly. They had a phone network all over the area to warn him if a helicopter was even heard before anything was seen. Mm-hmm. And he was out the door like a shot at the first sign of a helicopter.
Mm-hmm. And Charles, it may seem as if this is pretty much known, but from your point of view, is this phase of the peace process over?
I think so.
Yeah.
Well, I take it back. Can I take it back?
Please.
If there is a strong move to disable the militant groups on the part of the Palestinian Authority and of Abu Mazen, the Israelis have said publicly, unequivocally, that there would be immediate payback to the Palestinian Authority for doing that, for starting to move to fulfill their commitment. So if they do it, they manage to do it without breaking into a full civil war, and the Americans and Israelis are good to their word, I think there's a possibility the thing could be saved.
Charles Radin, thank you.
My pleasure. Take care, Robin.
Charles Radin of the Boston Globe speaking to us from Jerusalem.
Now, this note about Iraq. A noble task is how U.S. occupation coordinator Paul Bremer described rebuilding Iraq as he went on vacation, taking his first days off now, since he went to Baghdad 4 months ago. The price tag, though, he said, will be dizzying. At least several tens of billions of dollars next year alone. And that's money beyond the more than $1 billion a week the Pentagon's already now gushing in the occupation. Bremer also said, however much money is spent, change will not come quickly in Iraq. There will not be enough electricity, Bremer said, until at least next summer. And that's assuming no major acts of sabotage. The Ten Commandments, displayed as 5,280 pounds of granite, has been moved today from out of the rotunda of the Alabama Judicial Building in Montgomery.
Lord, you are holy God, and we have deeply, deeply offended your holiness. And Father, you said to much as we give, it much more shall be required. And you've given us so much light, so much blessing, so much protection, Father God, so much blessing.
Emotion still running high in Montgomery as hundreds continued their vigil to protest the Ten Commandments removal. The Chief Justice of Alabama's Supreme Court, Roy Moore, is presently suspended for his refusal to remove the monument he had put there in the first place. Well, for the latest on this, we're joined now by Melanie Peebles, a freelance reporter for National Public Radio, who joins us from Montgomery. Welcome, Melanie.
Thank you.
Melanie, paint me a picture, if you would, of the scene right now at the Alabama Judicial Building.
Well, people are praying. There are ministers reading from the Book of Psalms. They're trying to minister to all the people here who are very disappointed that the monument has been moved out. When it was moved out, many of the supporters lay down on the cement plaza out here outside the building, and they said they were lying prostrate in contrition for God for what had happened.
So the monument is gone.
Monument is gone. It's been moved out, not out of the building, just into another room, maybe just in a smaller private room or a closet. We can't tell, but from looking through the glass, we saw the company come in and move it.
Melanie, what's the mood there? Is there any possibility, do you sense, of trouble, of the protests becoming less than peaceful?
There seems to be very little chance of that. The person who has been sort of leading all of this is the director of the Christian Defense Coalition, Patrick Mahoney, and he's worked very hard to make sure nothing like that happened. Now, if the monument had been moved out of the building, that's something people were a little worried about because the supporters had said they would kneel in the door, in the exit of this building, to keep anyone from taking the monument away. But since that didn't happen, in fact, they can't even go in the building. The only people who are allowed in the building right now are those who have appointments inside.
Where is now suspended with pay Alabama Supreme Court Justice Roy Moore, who had the monument installed in the rotunda of the courthouse and fought to keep it there?
Well, he's not here, and he's been denied access into the building. He can't talk with members of his staff since he's been suspended, and supporters here haven't heard from him since Friday, in fact.
He faces an ethics inquiry by the state's Judicial Inquiry Commission. What could happen to him?
Well, he could be reprimanded, he could be disciplined, or he could actually be permanently removed from office. Hmm. Of course, a lot of the supporters in the crowd here are hoping that he will run for another political office, perhaps U.S. Senator or governor.
I see. Is there any sense of compromise in the air at all there, Melanie? Other displays of the commandments in government buildings, including in courthouses, have been ruled legal by federal courts so long as they're not, in the words of one decision, in your face.
That's right. That's what the group of supporters here have said all week. They mentioned that, well, these displays are in other buildings and that the U.S. Supreme Court, in fact, has a relief of the Ten Commandments outside the building. They don't see any distinction between those displays and this one, but they have said one of the things they're going to do is to move from state to state that have these and work to fight to make sure that the displays are allowed to stay.
Well, just to finish up then, is it possible that the Alabama Judicial Building could eventually end up with a Ten Commandments not so in your face? Do protesters want that? Could that happen?
I think that's something that might happen here. A lot of Alabama's political leaders had said all along that they believe the Ten Commandments had a place in a state building, but they just couldn't go with Moore. You know, they had to oppose Moore because what the federal courts had handed down.
Melanie Peebles, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Melanie Peebles is a freelance reporter for National Public Radio. She joined us from Montgomery, Alabama.
Care to share your thoughts on the program or the news? Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397.
Please remember to include your name, phone number, and the town where you live.
And just ahead, Cape Cod is known for its beaches and clam shacks, but did you know it's also a hotbed for budding Major League Baseball players?
And later in the program, a new take on Julius Caesar. Is he really as bad as history's painted him? I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Oh, say can you see by the dawn's early light?
September is the last month of the Major League Baseball season, but teams are already looking forward to next year. And recently, their scouts descended on Cape Cod to find out who the superstars of tomorrow will be. The Cape Cod League is the Ivy League of baseball. Alumni include Mo Vaughn, Nomar Garciaparra, and Tino Martinez. In fact, almost 200 of today's Major League players got a big boost playing on the Cape. Recently, players, spectators, and scouts spoke to producer Andrea Silverman at this year's All-Star Game in Falmouth, Massachusetts, on the Cape.
Play ball! Ron Gartner and the Bourne Braves, number 16, Tim Grant.
My name's Tim Grant. I'm from Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. I go to Dartmouth. I'm a pitcher for the Bourne Braves.
When you found out you were going to be on this team today, what was your reaction?
It was beyond my wildest dreams. You know, to get invited here and just to enjoy this experience is incredible. I'm a Canadian kid. I go to a small Ivy League school in the Northeast, and you know, these are all the big boys. These are all the guys you're going to grow up and watch on TV, and that's something I aspire to do. And you know, I feel like this is a step along the way to prove that I can do it.
Batting third from Maryland, representing the Bourne Braves, number 37, left fielder Justin Maxwell.
My name is Justin Maxwell. I go to University of Maryland. I play center field there. And today I think I'm playing left field. And I'm playing for the Bourne Braves. And our team's in first place right now. And I got picked to be on the All-Star team, and I'm having a lot of fun.
How much of an honor is that to be on the All-Star team?
It's a great honor because most of the guys here, like in the past, who've made the All-Star team here, have gone on and done better things in professional baseball, and hopefully things will work out for me, and someday maybe I'll be in a Major League uniform.
Is that something you've thought about for years?
Yeah, it's been my dream since I was a little kid playing Little League to one day play Major League Baseball, and I'm just trying to do it step by step.
There are a lot of leagues around the country that you could play in. Why did you want to come to this one?
I heard that this place is the best summer baseball league in the country, so I really wanted to get up here.
What's it like looking over at that section where all the scouts are sitting?
You try not to think about it when you go out there. You just try to play your game. And because if you really think about the scouts all the time, you're not going to play well. So you just try to clear your mind out. Just play the way you know how to play, and everything will work out well.
My name is Stan Meek, and I'm the scouting director of the Florida Marlins, and here really to look for guys that we think are prospects that we can look for the draft in the years to come.
What does it mean to be a scout? What do you do in your job?
Actually, you know, a scout is a guy who basically is trying to see something before it actually happens. The scout is the guy who sees maybe some things that they think a guy can be in the future that maybe he isn't right now.
What are you looking for here today in the players that you watch?
Well, I think one of the things, since these are all college players who normally play with the aluminum bat, we're trying to see from the hitter's end how they handle the wood bat. Trying to see who has the strength to drive the ball with the wood bat, see how they handle it. And from the pitcher's end of it, since they always face the aluminum bat in college, we're trying to see guys how much they like to use their fastball and will they use their fastball in, throw the ball inside on a lot of the hitters.
After three complete here at Gov Fuller Field, the West All-Stars lead the East All-Stars 1-0.
I'm Amy Brand, my husband Steven, and our son David. We live here in Falmouth.
We can find a place on the lawn, put the blanket out, sometimes bring the dog and bring in dinner and just sit there and watch baseball. It's great.
Ice cold Coca-Cola.
And we're right there.
What I like is what you see is families. You see parents and grandparents and kids, and you see, you know, the 10-year-old kids running around after in a pack after foul balls trying to get the ball. You see the teenage girls all dressed up hoping at the beginning of the season to, you know, catch the eye of some of the ball players.
I'm Lauren, I'm from New York.
Christina from Boston.
Julie from New York.
What's it like to come watch these guys play?
We've been having a lot of fun. The crowd is pretty happening, and the game has been really exciting. It's been a good time.
What do you think?
I think just being able to see so much like talent out there on the field is pretty exciting.
And the guys aren't too shabby either. I'm sorry, I gotta say that right now.
My name is TJ Labonte. I'm 12 from Brewster. I'm the bat boy for the Brewster Whitecaps.
And what are you doing right now?
Getting all the people's autographs and stuff like that.
It must be pretty cool to get all these autographs.
Yeah, it's really nice to meet all the players. They're really nice. They all like it down here on the Cape for the summer.
Number 37, Justin Maxwell.
What is that like to see little kids come up to you?
It's a blast because like, I've never been exposed to anything like this before. Like, you see all the major leaguers do it all the time on TV. And it's just a great honor to be able to, like, make a little kid's day.
Does it matter if you make the major leagues or not?
It's my goal. And it's definitely what I want to do, pursue as a professional career. But, I do well in school, so I always have a backup plan. But I'm going to put all my efforts into making the big leagues.
That was an overhand curveball by Tim Grant. Just laid it right over the outside corner of the plate. Nice pitch by Grant.
Are we going to see you on a major league team someday?
I hope so. That's the dream for sure. I hope it works out, but we'll see. Long way away.
And if it doesn't?
If it doesn't, I think I'll put my Ivy League economics degree to use probably. Hopefully, cross your fingers one more year, but yeah, we'll see.
Sounds from this year's Cape Cod League All-Star Game, produced by Andrea Silverman. For more information, check out our website, here-now.org. Whatever tomorrow brings,
I'll be there. Tomorrow on Here and Now, British TV recreates closed-door testimony about Iraq's weapons program.
Stay with us. There's more ahead Here and Now. I'll be there. To waver my chance to be one of the high. Will I choose water over wine and hold my own and drive? Than me before, it seems to be the way.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, a new way to lower tuition at some of the country's most expensive private colleges. Pay now and save a lot later.
And speaking of paying for college, a protest of soaring tuition at a state university in the form of a lawsuit.
Also, cutting one of history's bad guys, Julius Caesar, some slack.
He wanted to avoid a civil war. Now, how is he going to do that? By giving the people a somewhat larger slice of the pie.
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Dolores Handy. A controversial monument of the Ten Commandments has been removed from the rotunda of Alabama's Judicial Building. Dozens of protesters continued their vigil, kneeling in prayer on the steps of the building as a 2.5-ton monument was wheeled out of public view in accordance with a federal court order. Alabama Chief Justice Roy Moore put the monument in place 2 years ago. A federal judge ruled last year it was unconstitutional and ordered it removed. Two more U.S. soldiers were killed in Iraq today in separate attacks. A third soldier is reported dead from a gunshot wound in an incident described as non-hostile. A total of 281 U.S. military personnel have been killed in Iraq since the war began. More than half of those deaths have come since President Bush declared that major combat in the war was over. U.S. forces in Iraq have a new tactic in their search for Saddam Hussein. They're putting up wanted posters all over Iraq. From Baghdad, Lourdes Navarro reports.
Wanted, one former Iraqi dictator believed to be hiding in Iraq. Reward $25 million U.S. dollars. In a tactic which is as old as the Wild West, wanted posters are being put up all over the country to encourage people to come forward with information on Saddam's whereabouts. The billboards carry the faces of Saddam and sons Odeh and Qusay. The sons' faces are covered with an X to remind the people here that they were killed by American forces. For those with any tips, the coalition has opened a telephone hotline staffed by Arabic speakers. Lourdes Navarro, Baghdad.
There's more criticism for NASA today, this time from America's first female astronaut. Sally Ride says NASA knew all along that foam was falling from the shuttle's huge external tanks after launch, but never did enough to fix it.
It was a very disturbing thing. The Challenger accident 17 years ago taught NASA lessons that it learned right after the accident. Put a lot of attention into solving those problems in the few years after 1986, but those lessons seem to have been lost.
Sally Ride is a member of the panel that investigated the Columbia disaster. A man allegedly shot at least five people in a Chicago warehouse this morning. Two of the victims were killed. Police say they shot the gunman, took him away in handcuffs. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow is down 19 at 93.22. The Nasdaq is up 3 at 17.74. It's 33 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Here and Now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Feeling a need for some protection from college tuition that goes through the roof and then continues rising somewhere into the outer stratosphere? Given up hope for even keeping a roof over your head if you've got a kid or two in college? Well, don't despair. More than 200 U.S. colleges have now signed on to the independent 529 plan for private colleges, which allows parents to prepay a child's future college tuition at a discounted rate. It's a way for parents to invest in a school years before their child goes to it and a way for schools to make some money up front. Joining me on the line is Dow Jones industrial reporter Jane Kim. And Jane, plans like this have been around for a while, have they not? Prepaid tuition, what's new about this?
All the prepaid plans that have existed before have been sponsored for state schools. So this is the first one that's just for private colleges only, which allows parents to essentially lock in a piece of the private college's tuition at a discounted rate.
Now, when you say a discounted rate, does that just mean you get to pay what the college would cost now as opposed to what the college might cost if your kid goes to school 10 years from now?
Right. You're essentially locking in whatever tuition the college is charging today. And each college that participates in the plan has to provide at least a discount of 0.5%. And most colleges have the option of providing a greater percent.
So suppose I've got an 8-year-old daughter and I want her to go to Princeton, and I've got $5,000 in savings in the bank. What can I do next week with that money?
You could use that $5,000 to prepay a portion of Princeton's tuition, whatever they're charging this year. So say, for example, the tuition at Princeton is $20,000 a year. If you invest $5,000, you'd essentially be locking in a quarter Princeton's tuition.
Jane, how this works is, let's say, as you did, that Princeton's tuition is $20,000.
Right.
You put $5,000 in. That's a quarter of that tuition. But in 10 years, it's $40,000. That $5,000 will still be considered one quarter of the tuition?
Right. The proportion remains the same no matter how much tuition will rise in the future.
What if my daughter doesn't want to go to Princeton or doesn't get in?
You can get a refund on your original investment. The idea is that if your child wants to go to a different college that's in the network, then you can still go to any one of the colleges, and you'd be charged essentially whatever the tuition was at the time you made your original investment. Or you can roll your money over into another 529 plan, say a savings plan or a prepaid plan in the States, or you can get your original investment back, which is capped at plus or minus 2% a year.
Jane, what are the advantages of this particular plan as compared to other ways to figure out how to pay for your kid's college?
This particular plan is probably best suited for families who strongly favor private colleges over public colleges, because many of the other 529 savings plans out there require you to go to one of the in-state colleges. The other advantage is that it's good for conservative investors, because you can invest in a mutual fund, you can invest in a 529 college savings plan, but your investments would be subject to the market fluctuations.
Now, of course, this does skew still toward more affluent families, doesn't it? Because even $20,000 tuition is, well, $20,000 tuition. It's a lot
right.
of money.
It's certainly not cheap. The thing is that there are a variety of private colleges that participate in this plan. So it's not just the Ivy Leagues or the really expensive colleges. There are a lot of smaller colleges, rural colleges, religious-affiliated colleges, where tuition would be much more affordable. And you can invest in this plan for as little as $25 a month, as long as you agree to invest a total of $500 over a certain period.
Jane Kim, thank you very much for joining us on this.
Thank you very much.
Jane Kim is a Dow Jones Industrial Wire reporter. She spoke to us from Jersey City, New Jersey. And now to public universities. Education isn't getting any cheaper there either. Tuition was up an average of nearly 10% across public universities and colleges last year. Now, as states face severe financial shortfalls, there are layoffs and cutbacks at many schools, and fee hikes of 15 to 20% are common. Now, at the University of Arizona, tuition is up an astounding 40%. That's prompted a lawsuit. Four students at the University of Arizona are suing the state and the Board of Regents, claiming that tuition hikes are a violation of the Arizona Constitution, which says that state schools should be, quote, as nearly free as possible. We're joined on the line now by John Kromko, a former Arizona lawmaker and now one of the students bringing the lawsuit. Welcome, John.
Hello.
Thanks, John, for joining us. John, how much is your tuition and how much has it gone up?
Our tuition is now $3,800, which is a $1,000 increase. So it's gone up about 40%.
I see. The tuition will sound kind of low to certainly anyone trying to send their child to a private school.
Well, what's happening, though, the whole purpose of the public education system was to allow middle-class people to attend. That's the whole purpose of the land-grant law, which set up a lot of these schools. And the idea is that you should be able to get an education that the middle class could afford. And what's happening now is the middle class is being priced out in the first place. And in the second place, almost all students are emerging from their education having hideous debt.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's what was intended. Our high schools are completely free in Arizona, as they are in most states, and nobody objects to that.
Now, these are tough times, John. Most people would agree a university education can't be free. Maybe what the state is charging is as close to free as it can be right now.
Well, that's what they say, but when they impose this increase, they realized it would create a hardship, so what they did, they provided that one-third of my increase would be used to pay tuition for needy students, which is terrible. That doesn't make my tuition as nearly free as possible. I agree that needy students should have some help, but they should get it from the taxpayers of the state, not by taxing other students. In addition, in Arizona, the tuition is being used partially to pay for the bonds to build the buildings, and I think that's a terrible situation. The state is going to end up owning those buildings, and I think it's an obligation of the state to pay for them.
Now, where does the lawsuit stand?
We just filed it on the first day of class, which was yesterday. Next week, we'll ask for a restraining order that the tuition increase part be set aside in an escrow fund until the case is resolved.
Well, let me ask you this, John. I mean, suppose your lawsuit did succeed, and then the university said, okay, we don't have enough money to run our university because there's no money coming from anywhere else. What then?
You know, it's a question of priority. They have the money in the first place because there are many other, you know, the university budgets are only part of the state budget. They have the money, I believe, and our legislature has been especially irresponsible, much like the federal government. They've cut corporate taxes every year for the last 10 years, and now they say there's no money. They haven't raised the taxation that they should have. It's very similar to what's happened with the federal government.
John Kromko, thanks very much for joining us on this.
Okay, thank you.
John Kromko is a political science student at the University of Arizona in Tucson. For more on this story and on the Independent 529 plan, visit our website, here-now.org.
Still to come, Julius Caesar gets a makeover from one historian.
You're listening to Here and Now.
Did you know that this is peak migration season for hummingbirds? And earlier this month, their flight plan brought one specific specimen through the backyard of Becky Landowski in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. It was a rare white hummingbird. So Becky called in naturalist Bill Hilton, who listens to Here and Now on WFAE in Charlotte, North Carolina. And Bill alerted us to the sighting. So Bill is here on the line to tell us about this. Bill, how rare is this white hummingbird?
Well, in history, we've only been able to record about 100 different white hummingbirds. Some of those were not albinos. Very few albinos have actually been caught and banded, but that's what I did. I went to Chapel Hill and captured this bird, put a band on its leg, and then released it.
And boy, we will let the listeners know how they can hear of that escapade. It must be very difficult to put a band on the leg of a tiny little hummingbird.
Yeah, there are only about 75 people in the United States and Canada that are allowed to catch hummingbirds and put bands on them, and I'm one of those people. So I travel around, and when there's an unusual hummingbird, I catch it, and we band it and release it.
Right. You used some weird contraption that was hooked up to a remote with a car remote. It was just really wild. But so then when you got the hummingbird, what's your reaction to seeing something like this? Can you describe it for us?
Oh, it's pretty spectacular. I've banded more than 3,000 ruby-throated hummingbirds that were normal hummingbirds. But this bird was very different. It almost glowed because of its white plumage. And then as I looked closer, I could see the pink eyes and the pink feet and a bill that was almost a sensuous orangish pink. Mm-hmm. And that's because there wasn't any melanin in this bird. It didn't have normal pigmentation. And so it looked very different. But it was quite spectacular, both on the wing and in the hand.
Yeah, and you had quite a crowd watching as you lured this little bird. And we should say, of course, you didn't harm it at all.
Absolutely not.
But quite a crowd assembled to see it.
Yeah, everybody from preschool kids to senior citizens were gathered in the living room there to watch what was going on.
Right. Now, Becky, who originally saw the bird and brought you in, she calls the bird Angel, and obviously they can pretty much know when it comes and goes. And now, because of the band, you can know if it's the same albino hummingbird every time.
Correct. And we're hopeful what will happen is that bird will show up someplace else and another bander might catch it, or heaven forbid, it might be found dead.
Oh.
A person could read that band number and call the bird banding lab in Washington, D.C. and tell us something about hummingbird migration.
And it's important to understand where they go because...
Well, habitat protection is very important for all living species. And we talk about these as being our ruby-throated hummingbirds, and they're not. They're a shared resource. They don't see these political boundaries between Mexico and the U.S. and Central America. They're flying from up here to down there to spend the winter. And if we know specifically where they go, it might be like the monarchs. It might be a very small location in Central America or Mexico that needs to be protected. And so the more we learn about hummingbirds, the more we can do to help them survive in the world that's being assaulted by all sorts of things.
Mm. And, Bill, just one last thought. As someone who sat and watched hummingbirds, I mean, it's just they're so tiny. And what they do is so extraordinary. Are you still amazed that they go anywhere at all, that they make it down that far?
Well, they break all the rules. You know, they fly upside down, backwards, migrate 2,000 miles one way. And many of the birds that I've banded here in York, South Carolina, have come back in as many as 5 successive years. So they're making that big round trip and finding my backyard and actually getting caught in the same trap for 5 consecutive years. Just phenomenal.
Yeah. Well, Bill, thanks so much for alerting us to the albino hummingbird named Angel.
Okay, I hope people will visit my website.
We will. We'll let them know how. Thank you, Bill.
All right, thanks.
Bill Hilton, Jr., naturalist at the Hilton Pond Center for Piedmont Natural History in New York, South Carolina. To see his report and pictures of the albino hummingbird, go to our website, here-now.org.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
History is a very imprecise science. Talk to any given group of people who experienced something that happened just an hour ago, and you can bet accounts of what exactly happened an hour ago will almost certainly differ. So imagine recreating the reality of what happened 2,300 years ago or so. That's when the 500-year-old Roman Republic ended. Julius Caesar took over, which has made him something of an historical rat. A brilliant military campaigner, sure. A charismatic leader, yes. But a tyrant too, right? More supposedly noble Romans, like the great orator and supporter of the Republic, Cicero, have been remembered much more glowingly than Caesar. We discussed Cicero on our program last week. We noted then, among other things, Cicero's hatred of Caesar. Well, today we thought we'd get another perspective. Was Caesar really all that bad? Historian Michael Parenti doesn't think so. He's author of the new book, The Assassination of Julius Caesar, A People's History of Ancient Rome. And he joins us on the line now from the studios of Youth Radio in Berkeley, California. Hello, Michael.
Hello, how are you?
Good, thanks. Michael, yours is an unorthodox view of who Julius Caesar was. Why was it important to you to present a different vision of who this very famous man was?
I thought that the history of the late Republic of Rome had really not been done justice, that the question was not only Caesar, but the many reformers who came before him who were trying to institute land redistribution, put a limit on luxury consumption, debt easement, rent controls, some basic bread rations for the poor. So they were doing these reforms, and all of whom, just like Caesar, were assassinated by the Senate aristocrats. So there was a record here of things that were rather at variance with the usual view.
How is it that we don't remember Caesar that way then, as a reformer?
Very good question. And that's one of the themes in the book, namely that most historians simply take their cues from Cicero. Cicero was one of the senators and one of the participants in the late Republic. He gleefully supported the assassination of Caesar, even as he pretended to be Caesar's devoted friend.
Cicero, indeed, in our conversation last week, was portrayed as a flawed, indeed vain man, but nonetheless one of the great orators, for one thing, but also a great supporter of republicanism, the late Republic that ultimately led to all the other republics that have existed on Earth and ultimately to our own democracy. How could it be that Caesar gets no credit for his, as you portray it in your book, much greater interest in democracy than Cicero's?
Well, it depends on how you define democracy, because what Caesar was also interested in was some substantive democracy, which included a better deal for the ordinary people of Rome. He was not a revolutionary. I want to clear that up. He did not propose to abolish the aristocratic class. He was not ready to confiscate all their many estates and lands and all that. He wanted to avoid a civil war. Now, how is he going to do that? By giving the people a somewhat larger slice of the pie. So all the classes would be kept intact, and he would rein in the overweening and insatiable appetites of the ruling aristocrats.
So why hasn't Caesar been given a fairer deal, in your estimation, by historians?
Because I believe most historians are locked in pretty much to that elite ideological perspective that Cicero handed down and picked up by all the ancient historians after Cicero, including Plutarch and Appian and Dio Cassius. And they all ascribe to this view. They all were slaveholders. They all were themselves very rich men. That's who wrote history in those days. And right on down through the centuries, you have people pretty much sharing that same elite class ideology, which is that the Roman senators were fine, upstanding men dedicated to the preservation of their republic. They weren't dedicated to the preservation of their republic. They supported assassinations, which was not a republican principle. They supported mass killings of popular followers who had agitated and were trying to pressure for a better life. So the republic was, as long as the republic served their interests, they were for the republic. But the minute those interests were infringed upon and somebody suggested that a better deal be cut for some other people, they were ready to depart from the constitutional measures of the republic.
So what was life like for the average Roman?
Tough. The rents were exorbitant because people had been pouring in from the countryside, being displaced from their lands by the aristocratic class, who then brought in slave labor. The rents were so high that families had to double and triple up, sometimes whole families living in one room. There was no proper ventilation or running water. Typhoid, typhus were common. Fires, many of these tenements were, you know, fire traps. Many of them just collapsed because they were so poorly built. Jobs were not always easy to come by.
Julius Caesar wanted to change that.
He did, yes. He actually, in one of his consulships, he declared a suspension of all rent payments for 1 year. Do you know how much landlords love you if you declare a suspension of rent payments for 1 year?
And many of those landlords were the ones who were running the Roman Senate, the ones who eventually assassinated Julius Caesar.
Correct, including Cicero, who was, although he didn't participate directly in the assassination, they ruled him out. But he was one of the biggest slumlords in Rome. That's true.
The same and Cicero that in our conversation last week was portrayed as a rather noble man.
Yeah, exactly. I don't find him personally. He's not noble. He's an ego-driven fellow, a careerist, toadying up to the aristocrats, constantly boasting about himself, using his power to promote himself constantly. I was not terribly impressed by Cicero at all.
What compels an historian to take on a book like this? After all, this all happened more than 2,000 years ago. Why do you feel, as a modern man, compelled to change the image of a man who lived so long ago?
I believe that the issues involved in the late Republic resonate to our own times. The question of people getting a better deal, the question of a small, obscenely rich elite wanting still more and wanting it all, the question of how democracy is often circumscribed and evaded and diluted and undermined and used just as a legitimating facade for powerful economic interests, the question of an empire that's built at the expense of the republic and for the benefit of the ruling imperial class. These are all issues that are still with us today. And to me, the hero of the book is not Julius Caesar or even the Gracchi or Clodius or those people who struggled before him or alongside him. It's the people themselves. And the people of Rome have been misrepresented repeatedly. The image the average American has of ancient Rome is of a group of distinguished-looking men striding about marble halls dressed in togas, an erratic emperor carrying on some one or another crazy act, and the arena bloodletting of people screaming for blood in the arena and gladiators hacking each other up. But Rome was, for 500 years before the emperors came in, for 500 years it was a republic, and the people of Rome were not an idle mob just looking for bread and circuses. They organized into collegia, they were called, into guilds. They agitated for all these substantive measures, for better job programs, for a bread ration, for land redistribution, and the like.
Julius Caesar was following the lead of the people, something he's certainly not much given credit for in history.
That's well put. That's exactly what I think needed some redressing.
Michael Parenti, we want to thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Michael Parenti is author of the new book, The Assassination of Julius Caesar, A People's History of Ancient Rome.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
Our production team includes Andrea Shea, Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Alan Cockle, Karen Miller-Medson, Lindsay Crudell, Stefano Katsonis, Jordana Gustafson, and Emiko Tamagawa. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna.
Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Tim Skog and Boris Trapatsky. Our web producer is Zach Christo. And special thanks to Doug Van Gossig at Nature's Songs.
The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for the news and these stories, Here and Now.
British TV is forced to recreate closed-door testimony about Iraq's weapons program. We'll talk to one of the actors.
And Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech, 40 years on.
That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.